All right, we have one more session this morning before lunch, and Rutgers is going to Suzanne. She's going to talk about the case studies that they have collected so far and information that they have retrieved in relationship to those case studies.
This has been amazing for me because, unfortunately, I haven't really been part of the CHEO project for the last year or so. I did have the chance to meet Jeremy and Maria about over a year ago. I've been working on other projects. Renee Edwards, who many of you know, really wanted to be here, but there was a schedule conflict, so I've had the good fortune, but she sends her regards. I'm going to do something a little different than what had been planned. I was reading through the case studies and was really, really impressed with all the things that many of you are doing. But I started asking the question as an evaluator. And somebody just mentioned the forest and the trees, I think, Monday, you just said, and I think it was a great segue. You are all so much on the ground and really are doing amazing things on the ground, but you're all doing somewhat different things, and there's overlap and not overlap. And so what I wanted to do is spend the time that I have talking with everybody's leaving, I think, spend the time with you this morning, talking with you and getting some discussion going in terms of what are we really calling a career coach, to really kind of step back and say, you're doing this in Montana, you're doing this in South Dakota, you're doing this at Red Rocks, you're doing this in Laramie, you're doing this in Kodiak. What is there an essence in terms of what is the career coach? And if there is, what are the lessons learned? And how can we begin to think about it and replicate it in terms of going the next step and generalizing? Okay, so where I wanted to start was is that the federal government has really invested in the whole idea of career coach. We're now at the TAA four rounds. Rutgers has been the third party evaluator on the first round, which was really focused on energy. And the career coaches have done upwards of 3,000 interactions with unique students. CHEO, I don't have the current numbers in terms of how many people you've been in touch with, but hundreds, if not thousands, as well. And you can see the federal dollars that are going into all of these. And now the third round is the CHAMP, which is about manufacturing. And there they've switched the name from career coach to career navigator. And this is one of the things that I'd like your feedback, because what is a youth career coach to one person is not a career coach to another, and I think it becomes an issue in terms of messaging and how your roles have been interpreted at different places given whatever resources there have been. Just quickly, what are some of the common elements? And there may be a different focus in terms of what the occupational sector is, but basically it's accelerating credentials. It's building stackable certificates and degrees. It's using online and hybrid education and technology. A very important thing we talked about before, I talked out of the box, out of the silo, sharing information, sharing what we've done. As a group this morning said, we don't have to replicate the wheel. Why don't we kind of use what's out there and then blend and build from that? But as I said, one of the things that the feds had looked at the literature and said, you know, student retention is really affected by what their interaction is with an individual on campus around a whole array of things. So they really wanted to have some career guidance and make that link between, and we were just talking about it, academics and academics and careers, because if a student knows why he or she is sitting in a course which they may not really like, but they know it is a step towards something that they really want, they're going to have a very, very different reaction. So what I'm highlighting, there's a lot of overlap, as I said, but what I wanted to highlight in each of these different rounds, there's some unique things that are going on. And for the career coach for round one, it was really focused on energy. and the energy sector, and wasn't really using a sector, even though there are sector projects, it wasn't really using a sector model for that. And the kind of the lead into others, talking to students about employment, which is not unique for that particular round. I think what's been really unique in CHEO, and I want to get, again, your feedback. The first part of this is a little talking to you, and then I kind of want to lay the context for us to have a discussion. So forgive me, but interrupt if I am not giving, you know, something you want to add to it or you have a question. So recruitment has been a major piece of many of your responsibilities, including assistance with program applications, developing clinical internships, and a lot about job fair and a lot about employer partnerships. CHAMP is moving a little away from some of the kind of the interactive into in terms of the program specific, and is really looking at the coach almost as a teacher and in addition to an advisor. And so the coaches will be, or what they're calling the navigators, are going to be talking about online strategies, professionalism. And I think many of you have been doing this on a one-to-one basis or as workshops, but not necessarily in a formal course that students are required to take. So that's a difference. Another major thing, which I think is really, really important, given the non-traditional student, is getting credit for prior learning. And this is a major piece in terms of connecting from the workplace to the educational setting back into the workplace. So the credit for prior learning has gone through a lot of legislative changes here in Colorado. I don't know in the other states if you're, do you have credit for prior learning in a formalized way in Montana or South Dakota, Wyoming?
We would like that for our program.
Okay.
But we're not there yet.
Okay, and that's become a critical thing in terms of the manufacturing because it's not necessarily an incumbent worker, it may be an unemployed worker, but he or she may have skills from the military. How can those transform into kind of coming in at a higher level in terms of whatever the certificate or the degree program is? So the federal government was thinking in terms of career coach. The whole idea was this advising, and initially it was called intrusive advising. And coming from a mental health background, I just found that really problematic. They didn't understand anything about advising if they're calling it intrusive from the get-go. I mean, this is not what advising should be about. And so Rutgers and many of the colleges in the first round were trying very hard to change the language. And language is really important because it's the lens from which you see and you're being seen. And you don't want to kind of talk to students about, well, I'm going to be doing intrusive advising for you, and then the barriers go up. So we really tried hard. We have tried very hard to do it, to change it into intentional. But even there, when you look at the literature, what is intentional advising? How proactive is it? How directive is it? How suggestive is it? How much is it really problem solving or giving the student the ability to problem solve him or herself? Is it in terms of capacity building? Is it, and this is always a problem for me, empowering? You can't empower anybody. You know, they have to empower themselves. You can give them the tools. So what component is that? The literature also talks a lot about students stay in a program if they feel that they're part of the program. If they feel part of a community of some kind, they are more apt to use the resources on campus or online than if a student just comes in, takes his or her class, and leaves. And this becomes a big issue, and I want to talk with you with the people who are doing mostly online and remote, because that becomes a real challenge. And the whole thing is for advising for success. So what I did was, looking through the case studies, and rather than report out some of the details, I'm again trying to step back and trying to find general themes that came out of the case studies and cite you. And so if I didn't cite the right person, I apologize, and please clarify that this isn't what you particularly did, it was your colleague who did it. And I know that with your coffee talks and with the other webinars, with the other in-person meetings, that you've exchanged some of these things, but I kind of wanted to put it into a framework. And so starting with career counseling, a lot of what is happening is information flow. But that means that you have to have the information. And where do you get the information? So what is the nature of information? How do students see information? How is information used? I mentioned before the link between academic and career and employment. Establishing partnerships with the employers and with the workforce center. And we've talked about many of these things this morning. But one of the things that I don't think people have recognized enough, and it came up over and over again, is that I see you, and I didn't have a chance, I see you as the center of a wheel. That you are the ones who are central to a communication feedback loop. That you are talking with students, you're talking with faculty, you're talking with workforce, you're talking with employers, and you are helping mediate the information flow and the communication between all of those. And I think that's a critical thing that hasn't, we've been talking, again, not necessarily silo, but kind of a linear, and I think it's a circle and a spiral that keeps happening. And I think we need to kind of attend to that. Many of you, but not all of you, are actually doing academic advising. This was a major part of the round one because they were also working with developmental ed students. But what is academic advising? And one of the things, again, that I think is a challenge to career coaches is that many of your colleges have a career coach and you have an academic advisor, and they are not in the same office, they might not be in the same building, they may be in different campuses, they may have different hours, and they see often, and I'm not saying you, but many of them see, this is what I do, this is my expertise. And unless there's a crossover between the two and a real integration, we are not necessarily serving the needs of the students in the best way. Academic support services, teaching, workshops, skills, time management. Christy, I think you were doing anxiety. Pueblo Maria was doing test anxiety. For many of the credentials, students are going to have to sit for state or national boards. People have a real problem. I know that I taught in social work schools and sitting for the state license. It's a major problem. We were trying very much to speak conceptually and problem solving in the classroom, but the exam was very finite and discrete. And how do you change your mind that after you've done this immersion class in a process, in a culture, to change that and to report out on a test that's really going to make a difference for your future? So that becomes a real thing, and I think it was Maria. At OJC, the coach in the first round started doing learning style assessments and found that was really helpful. Helping a student, we all learn differently, we all take in information differently. So are you a visual learner? Are you an auditory learner? Do you have to actually participate in something to learn? And then how can you convey that?
Can I just interrupt for a second? Sir, I'm not sure if everybody knows what OJC is. It's not Otero.
Oh, I'm sorry. Otero.
It's just
Livona. It's
a tiny
not
little
here.
Town in the southeast corner of Colorado.
Right. Sorry.
It's Livona.
It's Livona. If she was here, she would talk about it.
Right.
She should be here any minute.
Oh, okay. Well, we've given her a welcome. And that's really been helpful because one size doesn't fit all. And again, that is one of the issues in terms of instructional designers moving things from face-to-face to hybrid to remote. Certain learners, it's going to really work well, but there may be some learners that it won't. And so what kind of strategies can you help those learners with? These have been issues that have been coming up, and as we blow through what we started as the tracking for students in the first round, and I think to some degree with the Stitching Report that Jeremy put together, the students have multiple hearts to themselves. They are students for a couple of hours, their parents,
their spouses, their partners, their workers, whatever, and all these things intrude and may make it more difficult for people to work. And I think it's Lavona again, who's not here, mentioned in her interview with Heather that there was a transportation issue for some student, and she helped the student get a bicycle. I know from the round one at Pikes Peak, which was one of the colleges involved, somebody had an exam, called the career coach, and the career coach picked them up because their car wasn't working. So, I mean, that level of interaction with students, and also the student feeling that he or she could call the coach for that. Now, that makes a difference, and I'll talk to that later, is if you have a program of 40 people, or if you have a program of 600, it's going to be very different in terms of your ability to work with them. Again, I want to go through these fairly quickly. We just now, in terms of what Lauren and Tara were talking about in terms of strategies for recruitment, and I haven't gotten all what you were just talking about here, but there's been an array, and what I did was I separated the internal and the external. In terms of what you can do within the college and the college community, and then what you can do actually out in the external. But Flat Valley was sending, identifying students who had taken some courses but didn't complete the credential may in fact be people that you want to call back, and one person was doing that. More of you may have been doing that. Job lead, job readiness has been another one that has been, I think, a very powerful one, that even if the student is in your program, then they get to know about the program and they meet other people, and that's community. So in terms of external, I mean, there's been, you know, talking about Twitter, Facebook, print, radio, now they have the hub in Colorado, there's Connect Colorado, there's just many, many ways in terms of letting people know. Working with veterans groups. I mean, some of the colleges are where there's a military installation, so their families, in terms of the military, either the person who's actively in the military or one of those individuals' family members. And just now, we were talking, Kristen was talking in terms of getting attention through the mannequin or through the simulation. While I'm talking about all of this, I asked the question of the first group this morning about ROI. What is the return on investment? How can you measure value added? And as I'm going through this, as I'm talking through this, I really welcome you to think about how are you measuring success? Somebody was saying, you know, this should be coming back, or I've gotten somebody to help somebody get a job. These are just from the data that you provided. The numbers are how many of the coaches actually use that. And you can see that intake in survey and classrooms and classroom presentations was a major way. How does that get translated then into a remote, totally online program? How is your presence then noted? In the round one, again, a general meeting with students, and academic counseling wasn't as important as the career counseling itself, so the career counseling was coming up. I don't know how many of your programs, there's a mandatory meeting with the career coach, and that is something that you might want to talk about. Here are the roles, and again, job readiness and anything to do with jobs. So that melds with your career coach position, but I know that many of you are doing many of the other things. This, again, is the number of meetings with students. And here again, if you have an 8-week program, you may only have an opportunity for one meeting, and that's it. And if you have a face-to-face campus, that makes a big difference than if it's remote, even in terms of establishing the relationship. But the thing that gets me very worried is that you may be able to serve the student really well by meeting him or her once, and you may not serve that student well by meeting with him or her 10 times. So to use how many times you're meeting with the students as a measure of your success doesn't really work. And yet that has been often used, but I just wanted to kind of give you kind of a thing. So what I'm doing is kind of throwing out the kind of dilemmas that we at Rutgers were kind of trying to grapple with, because we really want to showcase what, in fact, you and your colleagues have been doing in each of the rounds. And while I am a qualitative researcher and really feel that that is a way to tell the story, unfortunately, the powers that be who fund things really like numbers. So how can we turn these things perhaps into numbers? Here again, ongoing contact. Here are some of the things, and again, we've been talking about how do you establish and how do you maintain relationships with employers. I think it's you, Christy, who actually went out with the workforce person, which makes, oh, so it was you, okay. So we have both sides of it, and that makes a real difference. And I think that goes back to what they were talking about this morning, is it's not duplicating things, but really working together and getting out of some of these institutional silos as well as regional. Work with the employers and advisory boards, that has actually been a component that was required of everyone. But to what degree has a coach been part of that in some cases? It's a little unclear. And also partnering with other coaches and all the different rounds and learning from what they've done. So this is really the guts of what I wanted to talk with you and get your feedback. As we're really looking at these incredible roles that you have and multiple roles, how do we make sense of it? What do we call you? How do we measure your effect? Given that in each college, the program might be at a different generation. It may be a new program that's just getting off the ground, which means that it takes time to ratchet itself up so you can't recruit. It may be an enhanced program. It may be a transformation from the class to online. What do you do with the online programs that are asynchronous, meaning that students can sit for their class at any time in their week versus a class that always meets at the same time online? Very different in terms of you having access then to the students or even generating some kind of discussions. I think somebody was beginning to work with Blackboard, which you can have a discussion thread. Is that a solution? I mentioned the size of the program. Where is the program based? The coach from Kodiak works all remotely because her program is remote, but many of them are military personnel or their families who then get deployed or redeployed so they can continue the program. But that makes a big difference in terms of how do you advise, what are the trends in a particular region in terms of their employment. If I'm working, you know, in Indiana for the military and taking this course, the career coach who's sitting in Red Rocks or in Laramie or in Great Falls is not going to be able to know what is going on in that particular area. So how can the career coach help that individual? What is the faculty role in terms of advisement? A lot of the programs, and not just in terms of health, faculty feel very strongly that you have to be a CNA or you have to be a welder to really advise students about a career in that particular program, because as a generalist, you may know a little bit, but you really don't know the intricacies. Are there other resources on campus who are doing advising? Here, I think that you're now splitting, working together, but splitting some of the off-campus and the on-campus. Is that a realistic thing for all of you? Does it work on some campuses and not on other campuses? There's not one size fits all. Many of you have multiple roles. I mean, you're doing the career coach, plus you're doing, I think you're doing some retention, Heidi, in addition, which feeds into career coach, but you're being pulled in another way, and how do you set priorities?
Some of you, your programs have had a long history with employers and workforce, so that may not be the top priority for you. And others, that is the exact thing that you need to focus your attention on. So that changes. Systems of data collection, and not just as an evaluator, but I was reading in one of the colleges that there was a real issue in terms of what kind of information can be shared between the college and the workforce center and vice versa. So if you're trying to break out of silos and there are these institutional barriers or firewalls of information, and I'm having that in terms of a college out in Grand Junction just trying to get Department of Labor statistics. The college can't release that. The Department of Labor can't release it. I mean, how do you work around that to really serve the student? Location of jobs in the industry. Some of the programs in energy were not located in Colorado. People were coming to the LIHTC program in Trinidad who were coming from all over the United States and then going back to New Hampshire or whatever for the LIHTC. The same thing for the wind energy program up at Northeast Junior College up in Sterling. People coming from all over. So how does that shape what the career coach can do or not do? What is the experience of the career coach? Who is he or she and where do they come from? It's very interesting. I mean, some of you have an education and teaching background. Some of you have a social work background. Some of you have a retention specialist background. There was a coach in a prior round who was a volleyball coach and was part-time as a career coach. And you would think a volleyball coach, well, she was a very accessible person, and she was meeting students in the gym and at the games. And so students felt that she was somebody they could go to. Unfortunately, her part really wasn't in the career coach part of it, and when she could become a full-time volleyball coach, that's what she went to. But it speaks to something that I think many of you have been dealing with, is how do you normalize your relationship with the students, that there doesn't have to be something wrong, but you can help them do something better. How do you make asking a question a norm? When I was teaching both undergraduate and graduate students, inevitably there was a student or students who would say, is it okay if I ask a question? Why in our society do we have to ask permission to ask a question if you're in school? But we have this mindset that it's not okay to need help. So how do you transform that this, in fact, is something that we all benefit from, and that it's okay. It's actually not okay not to ask the question and not to seek help. But how do you do that? How do you do that in terms of a face-to-face, but even more importantly, how do you do it in terms of those of you who are moving into a more remote system? And again, I want to lay these things out and have you just kind of brainstorm with each other and with me. What is the stability of the project itself in terms of the leadership or a career coach? Because these are grants, there's often a lot of turnover, and so there's some cases a wonderful passing of the baton, but there's others disconnect. There's also been disconnect who writes the proposal and who's there to implement the proposal. And that's a huge disconnect on many levels. And we've seen this in every single round, that colleges have a grant writer. It's money. Let's go for it, right?
Now what?
Let's go for it. You've been living this. Okay. So let me I've kind of thrown out a tremendous amount, and what would be really helpful is you start where you think are the ways to conceptualize your job, knowing that, in fact, your colleague may do something different, but that we can actually advance this idea of what you're doing forward. Because it would be really too bad is if you all do wonderful jobs at your own individual college, and then when the money goes away, you go away. So how do we really advance the value added? Can your college imagine the college without you? What is life without a career coach? I don't have the bean bag.
Oh, yes. Who's got it? Oh, somewhere is it? It's up to Cody to get started.
How are you measuring? How do you measure success for yourself or for your role as a career coach?
I am a student-centered, like that's my perspective, I guess.
Okay.
So it's how fulfilled the student is and confident going into the workforce or getting through, you know, that's how I measure my success.
Okay. And how does the college measure your success as a career coach?
Numbers and placement and meeting the objectives of the grants and
mean going forward, I mean the numbers, I'm sure you have affected many people in many different ways. Is that captured for the college in a way that institutionalizes that role? And that's what I want to try to brainstorm with you of how we can move. It's a very slippery thing because, yes, you've had X amount of unique student contacts. You've had X amount of students who've gotten jobs or you've gotten credentials. But I'm sure you've also touched students who may have not completed and that you've really transformed their lives, even if it was a decision not to pursue a degree. But you've given them the confidence to go back and do whatever they.
And right now, I think, I'm thinking of some of those examples where we may have touched or worked with a student, or how did we get them the confidence during their ongoing time with us to get a different job that's higher paying, that when they aren't graduated yet, but we know that confidence and that resume work or whatever has affected it. And that is, I guess, what I am interested in capturing. And it can't be all through this stitched in. We can put in some of those things of student got part-time job to go full-time after graduation, but it's not really, I don't know how we're measuring that right now. How do we change that? We want the UI data at the end,
right.
But it's at the beginning of intake when they had nothing to, I needed a job and we found something at a temp agency long-term to now she's graduating. To me, that middle is just as successful.
Exactly.
So, you know, where do we put that we can put those changes in there? Because I do want to capture that.
Have others of you had that experience in terms of that middle section that kind of, you know that that's made a difference in terms of the end point, but you don't know how to capture that?
Because they're still in the program because of a different job.
Right.
So they haven't dropped off.
So I don't know, in the retention world, do you have ways to measure not just the end point? I mean, I know that there's a measure in terms of how many continuous semesters or one that follows each other. Are career coaches using that as a, you know, people come in time one and it takes 4 semesters to get, so we have X amount of students who've actually stayed in versus before the career coach we had fewer?
We were a brand new program when we started, okay. So we don't have that, but you know, what we should be doing is a beginning of semester survey. We talked about it. We got a lot of ideas, but if we could every semester that they continue on with us, it's a basic survey of are you employed, how many hours, where at, blah, 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 blah. That would be something that we could or should have done to continue to capture some of those things. And they could have changed mid-semester, but at least it would be something.
Right.
Versus what's changed since your initial application of not being employed.
We're trying to resolve some of that with a how to intake survey. Ask those questions, and I think as we really fully roll that out, we will find that we're missing a few questions that can better tell those stories, and then those stories begin to really lead the way for us in our discussions with DOL and other colleges and building those articulations and whatever else that needs to happen to create retention and success.
Are you with the programs that are new, like yours, Anne? Are there other programs on campus that have existed that have had issues, let's say, with retention that you can use as perhaps not a pure comparison, but to show the difference. Of course, your program may have other components, which of course is going to intrude on the findings.
And there might be some where the only online program in LA Health.
Okay.
And a lot of those, even the other, and I'm just thinking off the top of my head, so help me out if there's other programs. CNA would be shorter than our either one semester to four semesters. A nursing, it's very different in that you have to basically quit your job to be full-time in the nursing program. And so that, to me, is not really a comparison.
Right.
It could be for some, but we really want to stress those people that are on a second career, have to go part-time because they have to work. That's the non-traditional student population. And they're non-traditional in a lot of our nursing programs, too. But they have the ability to go to school full-time. Sonography, they're coming back a lot of times after a prior degree. And some of ours have the prior degree, but it's still very different. So I could think a little bit more about that, of what other programs exist.
Have any of you, the rest of you, in terms of looking at retention from one semester to another, has that been something in terms of that your, I wish I had a blackboard, but that your presence has made a difference in terms of that retention? And we're not yet talking even about employment or, of course, it will come out eventually, but for those students who step out for a while from a program, do not get the credential, but get a job.
Again, Suzanne, the Hub is offering those social-emotional wraparound connectors. We're not tracking who goes where with that. There's some legal ramifications around some of that tracking, but I think people recognize that's important.
Right.
And we spoke loudly that we wanted that included in the Hub.
Yeah, sure.
Suzanne, I'm just wondering, at the institutions that are participating in this grant, how many have student information systems that have alerts in them that send you messages about students have missed so many classes, or they have low grades on tests, or other kinds of things?
They're starting to implement something at LTRIP. But because it's just Dawn and one or two other of us that are the HITM program, I'm in all of her courses, or I have access to. So I can go in and look at class lists, or she can say, hey, so-and-so had a miscarriage. She's going to be falling behind. So-and-so is moving. So I know those on that personal level, but they're working on it at the college-wide.
We have an early alert system that faculty have to implement the early alert based on low attendance or low scores or zeros or whatever the case is, and then it goes to the person who manages that, and then she filters those alerts to the appropriate advisor to follow up on, or she follows up on that. But yeah, those non-cognitive factors are usually the contributing.
But are you capturing then the part that the career coach is playing, or the career coach is not part of that?
If it gets caught and transferred into the CHEO documentation, yes. But sometimes it doesn't, because they're separate, systems.
But they could be revealed in those individual stories. Maybe part of the answer to that. And we are reporting on the early warning systems and the quarterlies.
Right. It's not automatically transferred into CHEO documentation. The intention is to do that, but otherwise I don't like it.
We're not measuring that on a formal basis.
Right.
That's probably a guess.
Right. That it's one thing that we have to do for, CHEO and for the feds. I'm trying to move you to think outside of that kind of more formal, and we feel as evaluators is that we want to not only tell your story, but to really move the concept of what you're doing to a more formal basis so that it can be used by others, because we know on the ground you're making a tremendous difference. And you know, you are, by your presence, making a difference for your students and for your employers, workforce, whatever. How does the college administration post-grant see what you've done? And will they see what you've done? And then will they recognize it in sustainability? Because it would be too bad if all the relationships, all the hard work that you've done kind of goes away within 2 years. So, you know, I'm coming from the sustainability.
And, you know, the using the data and identifying ways, because I know it is so difficult to capture all the good work you're doing, because so much of it is happening on that individual, you know, the encounters you're having, and then, you know, how do you record all that, and how do you get that out? So I know that it's difficult, but and I've been pushing for our 9 community colleges to do work right from the start of capturing that the best they can and trying to get to their leadership in their colleges. So we've had some success, and one in particular, they developed a new pathway to employment center that was new and co-located with the WIB. And it obviously is grant supported now, so how do you keep something beyond the life of the grant? So the director did a really, really good job of capturing data and demonstrating how student retention was being impacted through intervention and also employment. So she then did a really nice presentation with all kinds of charts and graphs and how their intervention through PLA and was helping and different things that they were doing, such as boot camps. You folks do them all, you know, tutoring, boot camps, whatever it is, trying to keep them from taking unnecessary courses, so they're decreasing time to completion. So she put all that in this presentation and got before the Board of Trustees. And as a result of that, you know, 2 years into the grant, they decided to hire her on full-time as a director with college monies. So, I mean, that's an extreme example. Not all are like that, but she really did such a good job of selling herself and her program. So any way that you can capture and then get to that executive decision-maker leadership.
Right. So the case stories that you're collecting, if you can formalize some of those, and I think some of you already have and you've posted, and I think in the newsletter it's some of those case stories, but to really up the ante is going to be really, I think, critical, because, I mean, we've saw it with round one. I mean, almost all the career coaches are gone after all the work and the investment, and to see 4 rounds of this, and we're talking millions and millions of dollars, not just in terms of the consortiums here, but across the country. Unless we kind of move this into a conceptual thing, that even if we know that it's not going to be replicated in each place, but really has some evidence, because unfortunately so much is based on metrics, even though it should be based more on measures in terms of what is the quality. Metrics meaning that you start here and you get to here. Measures are much more of a kind of a process quality. So we want to tell your story in a way that we can convince the powers to be, and that's what we see our role as evaluators. We've always said, not here to see what you haven't done. We're here to see what you've done and why and how it's worked and what your challenges are to get that story out. Other thoughts in terms of how to capture this?
Could we be getting more? And I know the DOL put out some questions for us to work through with our students. Will there be any more focused questions that we'll get from Rutgers?
For the students.
For us to work through students, for to collect more of that qualitative data. You have the Stitchin report.
Right. Well, do you think it would be helpful? I mean, one of the things we've tried, for round one, we did a student survey, and I think the response from the student, because it's voluntary, was about 20%. And, of course, the students then who respond are going to be the ones who really got a lot, or the ones who were so outraged that the coach didn't do X, Y, or Z, so we got those. So student surveys, unfortunately, have not worked unless it's going to be in a mandated, and you don't want a mandate. I mean, it's kind of a violation of people's personal rights, so you don't want to do that. But we would be happy to work with coaches in terms of if you feel that that would be helpful, you know, and if you feel that because of your presence, if you're the one who's doing it rather than them getting it from this anonymous entity called Rutgers, we would be happy to talk with you about your ideas. We have tried when we go out for site visits to always have some time to talk with students. And that's been just really, really wonderful because they really have a lot to say. Much of it very positive, but they also identify what we then can feed back and strengthen programs. And again, it's a loop in terms of strengthening the programs.
Well, I'm going to have to.
Oh, go ahead.
Cut this.
So if you have ideas, please let me know, and I'll give out my cards. But of course, you can always use the Rutgers email to get to us. But thank you. And thank you for all your work. I mean, it was wonderful for me to read through all the case studies and just dress for success, you know, what works and what doesn't work when you walk in, and those kind of very visceral kinds of things that some of you are doing, which is really terrific.
Rutgers has done such beautiful work around this. We appreciate you and your whole team. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been great to get to Boulder.